At this time, the coalition of business interests and local officials fighting the IWW in the West came to feel that the only way to get rid of the IWW was to enlist the aid of the federal government. The Espionage Act of June 15, 1917, followed by the Sedition Act of May 16, 1918, provided the legal basis for federal action. Wartime patriotism provided a favorable climate of opinion. A plan suggested by former Governor John Lind of Minnesota, then director of the State Commission for Public Safety, envisaged a coordinated offensive by the Justice, Labor, and Post Office departments to destroy the IWW as a functioning organization. The Department of Justice would raid IWW offices to obtain evidence of violation of wartime security statutes and would prosecute the IWW officers responsible. The Department of Labor would detain and deport IWW aliens, and the Post Office would deny mailing privileges to IWW publications. Basically, the Lind plan would use the tactics already developed at the state and local level under the protection of federal legal sanctions to attack radical labor on a nationwide front. This program was put into effect during the summer of 1917. In July, President Wilson established a special investigation of IWW activities. Shortly afterward, there was an unexplained break-in at the IWW National Headquarters in Chicago. In August, the Post Office denied mailing privileges to two foreign language IWW newspapers. On August 21st, the U.S. Attorney General informed the President of a planned full-scale assault on the IWW by the Department of Justice. On September 5th, federal agents and local police raided every IWW office and headquarters throughout the country and the homes of a number of high IWW officials, armed with extremely broad search warrants that allowed them to seize not only documents, but also the operating equipment of the offices as well. Large numbers of IWW members were arrested. The raids were expected to immobilize the IWW as a functioning organization for the duration of the war. The organization's leaders were arrested, its office equipment gone, its funds sequestered. But to make doubly sure, a second series of raids, a few months later, shattered the secondary leadership that had sprung up after the first raids. Then came the trials, with public opinion whipped to almost hysterical hatred by the press. 99 IWW leaders were prosecuted in a widely publicized trial in Chicago in 1918, convicted on extremely flimsy evidence, and given long prison sentences. 47 secondary leaders were tried in Sacramento later in the year, and 25 in Kansas City in 1919. This federal action was supplemented by many arrests of local IWW leaders under state criminal syndicalism laws. Meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Labor was active in two ways. On the one hand, it deported numerous alien IWW members. On the other hand, it sought to replace the IWW with the AFL unions in the lumber and mining districts where the IWW had been strong, and to develop collective bargaining there. This effort was assisted by Samuel Gompers of the AFL and by Ralph Easley, who for many years had been with the National Civic Federation. The War Labor Board and the War Labor Policies Board supported these tactics unofficially. These efforts were unsuccessful, however, and the open shop prevailed. Nevertheless, it was the policy of the Wilson administration to encourage unionization and collective bargaining by job-conscious unions, while it destroyed class-conscious unions. The same methods used by the federal government against the IWW were used against the Socialist Party. Socialists had often supported the IWW, particularly in its spectacular strikes and the free speech strikes in the West. Both the IWW and the Socialists had opposed U.S. entry into the war and gave, at best, lukewarm support to the war effort. The Socialist Party was the next logical target for suppression of radicalism, particularly after the Bolshevik seizure of power in Russia in 1917 aroused increased fear of communism. Socialist periodicals were denied use of the mails, socialist leaders were jailed under the wartime security laws, and party offices were raided. The attack on left political organizations culminated in the notorious Palmer raids of 1919 to 1920, planned by Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer and directed by the young J. Edgar Hoover. Federal suppression of the IWW also coincided with passage of criminal syndicalism legislation by a number of state legislatures. These laws were directed at the IWW, although that organization was not specifically named in any of the laws. The usual pattern included a press campaign attacking the IWW on patriotic and ideological grounds, and organized support for the legislation by trade associations and other business groups. Starting with Minnesota in 1917, most of these laws were passed in 1918 and 1919, and they were the basis for criminal prosecutions of radicals in general, Wobblies in particular, and even some liberal activists. Widely publicized show trials and long prison terms were common outcomes. Other events added to the atmosphere of hysteria, fear, and class conflict. The Russian Revolution of 1917 and seizure of power by the Bolsheviks under Lenin's leadership, the bitter 1919 strike in the steel industry, the NAM's intensified drive for the open shop starting in 1919 to 1920. The federal government's suppression of the IWW and drive against radicals was part of a larger economic, political, and ideological confrontation between capital and labor, in which capital was generally successful. Epilogue. Workers in the industrial America of the period between the Civil War and the First World War worked out several alternative paths toward solutions to their problems. Two were allowed to develop: job-conscious business unionism of the AFL type, and political action within the framework of existing political institutions. Both of these approaches accepted the existing economic order and offered no serious challenge to patterns of income distribution, the ownership of wealth, or the locus of economic and political power. A quote-unquote fair share within the existing structure was their theme. Two other adaptations were not allowed to exist: a labor movement emphasizing mass action, class consciousness, and a radical ideology, and radical political action directed toward socialism. Here we have examined in detail only the repression of radical labor. Yet radicalism in the labor movement was as American as baseball, hot dogs, or pumpkin pie. It developed out of the American experience with industrialization, starting with the disorganized mass protests of 1877 and leading through the Knights of Labor in the 1880s and the industrial unionism of the 1890s, to the IWW in the early decades of the 20th century. It was not a radicalism imported from Europe, nor did it have its roots among intellectuals or the urban middle class. Radicalism of those sorts was present in the half-century between the Civil War and the First World War. Marxism and anarchism from Central Europe, utopian socialism, Bellamy's national movement, for example. But the radicalism of the IWW was different. It reflected the lives and experiences of working people in industrial America and was forged from the conflicts inherent in that society. We can now come to a better understanding of the question we started with. Why did class-conscious radicalism not develop with the American labor movement? It did. Mass radical movements in the American labor movement had great vitality between 1877 and 1917. The question was the wrong one, stemming from the failure of American historians of labor to look impartially at the facts. The question should be, why did the developing class-conscious radicalism of American labor lose its momentum? It was attacked by the power of the national state, which also clearly indicated that similar ventures in the future would not be tolerated. There is little need for complex theories about the role of immigrants, fractionation of the labor force, middle-class public opinion, and so forth. All those factors were present, but the fact remains that repression by the state was the key difference between 1910, say, and 1920. We should not think of that repression in the simplistic terms of reductionist or quote-unquote official Marxism, of a capitalist state single-mindedly serving the interests of the capitalist class. Capitalists, as a class, were divided on the issue of how to deal with class conflict, just as were workers. Similarly, labor leaders were obviously trying to work their way through a difficult situation in which a variety of pressures were at work. Gompers, for example, felt that, in the long run, his union could not survive if it took a radical stance, and he may well have been right. Complex political forces created a coalition of labor conservatives and corporate liberals around a policy of collective bargaining and ameliorative legislation as an alternative to class warfare. The suppression of labor radicalism followed, almost as if the progressive liberal coalition was trying to mollify the conservatives by destroying their chief enemy. Governmental repression was made possible, however, by the isolated political position of radical labor. It was probably a minority within the labor movement itself, among rank-and-file workers, although this is far from clear. Certainly, the great majority of the leaders of organized unions were opposed to a radical transformation of property relationships along the lines advocated by the IWW. Furthermore, while the IWW represented a high point in the economic organization of mass radical movements in American labor, there had not been a parallel development of a radical political movement. The Socialist Party was itself divided among divergent factions, and its political program was not closely articulated with the class-conscious radicalism of the IWW and its emphasis on economic action. The IWW in particular, and radical labor in general, was in an exposed position, isolated from other sectors of the working class, and without a supporting radical political organization. It could readily be offered up as a sacrifice to conservative business interests by the coalition of corporate liberals and conservative union leadership. The final victory of the supporters of collective bargaining and ameliorative legislation as an alternative to the class struggle did not come until the New Deal years of the 1930s. And victory did not come without turmoil. At that time, the labor radicalism of the years before 1918 had disappeared as an effective force, and even the revived industrial unionism of the 1930s was molded by business unionism. Without the older labor radicalism to worry them, employers took a largely unified stand in opposition to trade unions, and a somewhat different coalition of economic and political interests developed around the issues of labor legislation. But that is another story.
Joe Hill was asked to write a song for those Southern Pacific Railroad workers. So he took a popular tune of the day and threw a new set of words at it and wrote a song about union scabbing. Then he wrote a little note to the industrial worker in which he said, "Union scabbing is as if you're about to be hung." And as he were led to the scaffold, the executioner turned to you and said, "Gee, I hate to do this, but if it's any consolation, the scaffold was built by union carpenters. The rope was made by union rope makers, and here, sir, is my card." That is union scabbing. Oh, the workers on the SP line to strike sent out a call, but Casey Jones, the union scabby, wouldn't strike at all. His boilers, they was leaking, and his drivers on the bum, and the engine and the bearings, they was all out of plumb. But Casey Jones, he kept his junk pile running. Casey Jones, he was working double time. But Casey Jones, he got a wooden medal for being good and faithful to the SP line. And now the workers said to Casey, "Won't you help us win this strike?"
That was Act 4 and the epilogue of The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor, which concludes our reading from the book. The songs accompanying this segment have been Joe Hill and Casey Jones, both sung by Utah Phillips. I'd like to thank Nan DiBello for her contributions to this series.
Casey Jones, he was an Angelino. I took a trip to heaven on the SP line. Now Casey got to heaven to the pearly gates. He said, "I'm Casey Jones, the guy that hauled the SP freight. You're just a man, said Peter. Our musicians went on strike. You can get a job of stabbing any time you like. Yeah, Casey Jones, he got up into heaven. Casey Jones, he's doing mighty fine. But Casey Jones went to scabbing on the angels like he done to workers on the FP line. And now the angels got together, said it was not fair for Casey Jones to go around a scabbing everywhere. And Angels Local 23, they sure was there, and they promptly fired Casey down the golden stair. But Casey Jones, he went to hell a-flying. Casey Jones and the devil said, oh, fine. But Casey Jones, get busy shoveling sulfur. That's what you get for scabbing on the FB line.
Colombia is portrayed in the American media as a cardboard cutout, a land filled with evil drug traffickers and terrorists, which must now be suppressed with the U.S. military and our tax dollars. The real situation is far more complex, as both the U.S. and Colombian governments have been deeply implicated in the traffic of cocaine to the United States. A Marxist insurgency movement, the FARC, has been fighting for 3 decades to defeat a series of U.S.-backed regimes that have continued to reduce Colombia to a cash cow for the global market. Colombia is being decivilized and impoverished by the same forces of globalization that have brought hundreds of thousands of Americans into the streets over the past year. Jesse Lynn spoke with Cynthia Mellon, a human rights worker affiliated with the Global Center at Rutgers University, who also serves on the Working Group on Women in the Economy in Bogota, Colombia. She will speak about the women who work in the export flour industry in Colombia. The situation of these women is illustrative as a microcosm of the forces of globalization at work shaping the maldevelopment of Colombian society.
Colombia does not have a maquila structure like Mexico and Central America. The maquila in Colombia is the flour production. Many, many, many flours that people buy in the United States and in Canada are produced in Colombia. The most beautiful flours are produced there. I can take a look at some roses and I know where they were produced because each one of those flowers is hand-tended individually by women. There's something like 70,000 workers in the industry who are, you know, primary workers who work directly with the flowers, and then a whole bunch more who work in packaging and all sorts of other things. It's a big industry. The flowers are grown on the plains of Bogota. There's a big thing we call the Sabana de Bogota, which is this big plain that surrounds, you know, it goes to the west of the capital city, where the conditions are optimal for the growing of flowers. Colombia, that high plain, it's not ever very hot there. It's a cool climate, it's cloudy. The flowers are growing in these plastic greenhouses. You know, if you're flying into Bogota, you'll see, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these long structures, and that's where the flowers come from. I know the statistics for Canada better because I work, you know, more closely with them. But in Canada, 60% of imported flowers are from Colombia. I think in the United States, it's more like 70%. Some of the things that are significant about the industry are, as I said, that most of the workers are women. And it's in the hands of very, very wealthy people. Azoco Flores is the Colombian flower growing, like the industry arm, the chamber of flower producers, we could say. It's a closed industry. Stocks aren't traded on the open market, so there are no annual reports. It's very hard to do any kind of research or understand what the actual earnings of that industry are. So people who are activists with those workers are constantly, you know, constantly doing all kinds of cloak and dagger stuff, trying to get understanding about like how much tax break they're actually getting and how much money they're actually generating, because it's all masked through different, you know, way shelters, we could say. The industry is interesting because it has a very devastating environmental effect on the savanna, and it has a very devastating social and economic effect on the workers. So there's this two-pronged approach by the people who are working in solidarity with them, which are that, you know, both the environmental situation, what it's causing to the land around there and to the communities on the savanna, and what's going on with these people. The flowers have been growing, started in the 60s, the industry, but it's been growing exponentially throughout the 90s. One thing that's very significant about the industry is that it was used to crack open the Colombian Labor Code. Before the early 90s, there were a lot of legislative changes in Colombia in the 90s, particularly in the Gaviria administration. Gaviria is now president of the OAS. And he was a real tyrant. He has this kind of smooth appearance, but, you know, he's a scary man. Things got really repressive under Gaviria's administration. And what happened was you had a pretty solid labor situation. I mean, people don't realize Colombia had pretty strong unions. It had pretty strong labor legislation. I mean, those are things that many people don't know about Latin America, that there's been a serious erosion of all of these things around globalization throughout the 80s and 90s, beginning in the 70s. You know, prior to World War II, you didn't hear this. Latin America fed itself and was solved. You can't compare, for example, Colombia to El Salvador. You can't think of two countries that are more farther apart, except they were colonized by the same, you know, outfit. So, you know, just to put it in one kind of perspective. Colombia is a big country. It has very fertile land. It has a very varied climate. You can grow anything. It has a population that's suitable to its size. A lot of natural resources. It has oil and gold. There's no reason for poverty in Colombia. That's why I always compare it to Canada. The only reason there's poverty in those countries is for lack of political will to distribute things better. There's no reason for poverty in Colombia. It's all there. You know, it could be a paradise. So, I mean, just to get that out on the table, that is a fact. You know, in the early 90s, there were people in the flower industry began to subcontract out the work. Prior to that, people were kind of hired by one finca or, you know, company, by a plantation. They began a practice of short-term contracting, subcontracting. You didn't know, you know, for how long you were going to work. Piecework, which is, you know, really dangerous. Quotas, making people compete against each other. A very precarious labor situation. This kind of began in the early 90s. And was against the law. What they were doing was illegal. However, they kept it up and kept it up till it became, there were two laws that were changed, and they actually changed the legislation. They had friends in Congress, and, you know, to me it's always very interesting, you know, de facto and de jure, like, practice and what's in the law. And so these people did and did and did what was illegal until they made it legal. So that started to change, and you had, you know, this now very flexibilized process. I mean, they set the pace, you know, for breaking, you know, labor solidarity and strength in Colombia in many ways. So now it's just a fact of life where people work, you know, one person hires you, another person pays you, you don't know how long you're going to work for, and so on. Coupled with that are very irresponsible use of pesticides, overuse of pesticides, use of pesticides that are banned in other countries, and use of pesticides in a way where it's very hard to dispose of liquid and solid wastes. You know, what happens with the runoff of the water that's being used to water the flowers that's full of pesticides. The soil on the savanna is contaminated. There are people who've done tests to say it's never going to come back. You know, coupled with this is the whole concept of using, you know, of appropriate use. That soil and that space is too damn good for flowers. Anybody who knows flowers knows that you can grow flowers on very poor soil with a real minimum of resources. In fact, they're using the best farmland in the country to grow flowers, and it will probably never make a comeback. So there's, you know, those issues, there's the labor issues. Several times there's been attempts at forming unions. There was a big strike and takeover about 14 years ago, I'd say. There's a film that's in the hands of the National Film Board. It's called Women, Love, and Flowers, or Love, Women, and Flowers. It's kind of an odd film, and I suggest that if people do watch it or show it in a classroom that you have time for debriefing, because it really messes people up when they watch it. Like, people will, like, be in tears and stuff, you know. So you want to be sure, if you do use it as a resource, that you have appropriate, you know, opportunity to converse, or a resource person present. But the film is now out of date. We have some new footage that we're trying to work into, you know, into something. In 1996, there was a strike and lockout at the last and only flour plantation with an independent union. That was a really interesting situation. The workers ended up inside the factory and holding the factory for quite some time. They tried to get the crop off in time for Mother's Day. And everybody was supporting them. I mean, from the central marketplace, they were sending out trucks of food. The church was on board, because in Colombia you have a situation, you know, to backtrack a little bit. Militant priests and nuns have been assisting the flower workers in that region since the 60s or 70s. Like, colleagues of mine were politicized through that. You know, their high school teachers or whatever would take them out to, you know, meet with those workers and so on. And those people have been kind of our guides in, you know, beginning to work. And the flower workers, who are mistrustful of many other people, trust the priests and nuns. And so they actually did a lot of good work in producing popular materials for them so they could understand the laws. And that's now what we call the pastoral obrero, or the workers' parish or workers' ministry for the whole country, is Facatativá, which is the main urban center where the flower workers are located. So that is a goal. I mean, as we say in Spanish, a goal, a game, you know, that the Catholic Church, which on the whole is very conservative, has recognized the militancy and the need to accompany those workers. And that means that even the bishop, you know, I was at a workshop for unemployed workers and the bishop showed up, you know, because he had to, you know, and he had to honor those priests, you know, who actually lived in poverty. You know, one just died and another is dying, and those have been our mentors in the process, you know. So there's some very interesting dynamics around the issue. There have been some, in terms of international solidarity, there's been a couple of interesting things. I should say that there is no, after they broke that union, and that was a concerted effort on the part of that company to destroy that union, the more established unions don't want to touch them, and it's also, people are full of fear about that organizing because people have died in the past. Right now it's, you know, Colombian trade union people are the most threatened of all. I mean, they die all the time. So there's been like some really tense moments, you know, close friends of mine who had to go into exile. And now most of the organizing is done by a small organization of women, and it's called Cactus, in Spanish Cactus, right? For a number of reasons, you know, this very hardy plant that has a flower but it has a thorn, and, you know, Cactus is a small group of people. There's a lawyer, they've now got two lawyers who are just handling casework with the people. You know, when someone doesn't get paid, or when a whole group of people don't get paid, I mean, they're on the program all the time, they're out in the villages all the time. There's a woman who has a social work background, she's now the president of the organization, and there's some former workers, and there's a psychologist on staff all the time, because people are, like, full of fear. And for a while there was a full-time person just doing pesticides who had to move on because he needed more money, but he's still, you know, there as a volunteer. And so that's kind of my scene. You know, I came in working with them just when the organization started, and have done work, you know, continually with them since 1995, which is why I got to go to this meeting, which is the first big meeting that the organization's been able to hold since 1996. For a long time, we've had the idea to bring workers together. You know, there was an effort made to bring workers from Africa, because there's a flower industry in Kenya and there's some in Uganda, although we never were successful in making contact with those workers. And also, the structure and the conditions are different. Again, I mean, maybe it's comparing apples to oranges, or maybe it's premature to try to do anything with them at this point. But at any rate, they did have people from almost every country in Latin America where flowers are produced at this meeting. So it was a very interesting meeting, because you had, they were looking at basically pesticide use, flower production, and genetically altered crops. They had two parallel meetings together, which was really interesting. And I haven't even found out why they did that, but I think it had to do with funding and also their closeness to Rapal. Rapal is, I only know it in Spanish, but Rapal is the pesticide alternative action network that has people. There was even someone from California who was in Rapal, and then there were people from all over Latin America. So Rapal held its annual meeting the day after this one ended. So I think that was what they did, was to get a lot of people there from their organization who were experts in pesticides, and then hold their meeting there all at once, and also deal with some other issues. So, and because the genetically altered agriculture is, I mean, that's now being dumped on the third world. People here were mad and afraid of those crops. They're starting to dump wheat and other things, either as donations or cheap sales, into countries that don't want them either. Obviously. You know. So it was really interesting. We had plenary session the first day, and we all heard about each other's issue. Then they had, the hotel was really neat. They had these big screens, and they could break the rooms up so we could function as two separate meetings. And the woman I was speaking to you this morning about, Margarita Flores, who was for years the environmental lawyer in the organization I worked at, she chaired the biodiversity meeting, and that's her work very much, or the genetically altered bio versus biodiversity meeting. And I think the flaw of the meeting was that we didn't get to hear too much about each other's issues, and I understand that was just a dynamite meeting. We just had tremendous people there. And in our meeting, we heard, you know, from people from all over the region. Ecuador sent a big delegation of people, including workers, all of whom are indigenous. Indigenous people work the flower industry in Ecuador. So that had very specific characteristics, and we heard a lot about how that's affecting communities and so on. And workers, employed workers, were only able to get one day off, and they were going to have their own workshop. They came the last day of the meeting. But we ended up changing because it didn't seem appropriate, so we all ended up just meeting together. One of the main proposals, and we've been looking at this over the years, was how to get the industry, if there isn't going to be a union, how to organize somehow to bring the industry to heal, you know, to enter modern times and admit that there has to be some conditions addressed. This takes us into the whole place of organizing with the consumer, you know, a place I'm not terribly comfortable with, but that, you know, we have had to explore as an avenue, in the same way that people are actually having some success with the fair traded coffee. You know, I mean, I consider these band-aid solutions because I'm very concerned about, you know, the optional nature of organizing for a consumer and the absolutely pressing life and death nature of organizing with the workers. You know, but nevertheless, reality requires that we check out all the options and also explore with allies in different countries what their suggestions are, just to see if there's any parts of those suggestions that will be workable for Colombia. And for several years, we explored the concept of a seal of quality because, again, trying to understand the Europe scene, which none of us knows very well or hardly at all. FIAN is a group in Germany that deals with food security. And then you have the other organization that's called Max Havelaar, which has a branch in Switzerland and Netherlands. Those are fair trade organizations. And then there's Trade Fair, I think. There's, you know, those organizations, they mostly deal in coffee. But in Europe, flowers are mostly sold in supermarkets, and there's like one branch that's really big. Like in Switzerland, there's some supermarkets that have fair traded flowers, I think. Or they're wanting to. Or they, you know, they sell fair traded coffee, they would be very interested. They did surveys. And many, many consumers said they would be willing to pay more for flowers that they knew were produced under environmentally sound conditions and fair labor. You know, but that was shocking to people in Colombia because nobody could imagine paying more for something. We had these, you know, interesting discussions. But this, yeah, it's easy. European people are crazy. They'll do it. So, you know, we went round and round in circles about whether this was viable. And lo and behold, I mean, the meeting we had in 96, there were some Germans there, and there were some kind of interesting people. And the industry sent their biggest wigs. I mean, they really, the president was there, and she lambasted it. She was kind of a nut. But, you know, they were there. And that backfired to some extent. You had Flor Verde, which was a branch of Azoco Flores, because again, you've got all of these flower producers. They're not all the same. Some of them are a little hipper than others. Some of them do have some environmental concerns. Some of them really care about marketing more than others. So for a variety of reasons, they came up with their own seal, which was not endorsed with anyone. And this again got into some very interesting, you get into sovereignty issues when you talk about this. And you get into it, people, what I'd say, like skewed sovereignty issue, where people are using a sovereignty argument for a not particularly honorable reason. You know, like, we don't want anybody policing or monitoring our flower production. We'll monitor ourselves when everybody knows that they're the abuser. That's letting the abuser monitor themselves. But then you still end up, you know, in these weird debates with them because the abuser might walk out and, you know, and you'll get nothing or worse. So this kind of stuff, we went around and around for a couple of years with it. And with the European groups really favoring this seal concept and working against time because the industry ended up developing Flor Verde, which what was very interesting to me was in 98, on CBC in Canada, they actually, there was a great interview where they exposed it. I couldn't believe it. They exposed Floreverde for the sham that it was. And I happened to be in Toronto speaking to a big meeting, really, of unions and church people and others who were looking, it was a fair trade study group. They were looking at all kinds of things about fair trade, and I got to go and talk to them about the things I'm talking to you guys about. First of all, I think it was really wonderful for a small group like that, a really grassroots group, to be able to pull that off. And we had a couple, you know, Rapal was a co-convener, and ILSA, my former organization, which is the Latin American Institute for Alternative Legal Services, ILSA, I began working with Cactus through ILSA, and even though I'm not there, I'm still the primary resource person for them, but that the organization has kept on board, and that was good. Institutionally, it was good to have those three types of groups convene a meeting like that. And it got some neat coverage in Mexico, in Cronos, in one of the news magazines. The meeting had really good coverage. A fellow there came from Germany, Ronald Kopke is his name. I'm probably not pronouncing it right. And he talked about the code of ethics, which has been brought in mm-hmm. in Nicaragua for the Maniquila, okay, mm-hmm. which is also something I have some familiarity with. And the network that, you know, throughout Central America of support for Maquila workers. And there was a lot of discussion about whether or not to do something like that in Colombia. And in fact, there was great suspicion on the part of the workers and other people. Like, Colombia is a different place. And you can't assume that what worked in one country will work in another. On the other hand, I'm not so sure they were making the right decision, but the people have so little experience with international things. And this was, Colombia's kind of a closed-off country in terms of receiving information, access to information. So this all seemed very new and suspect to them, and they were convinced, rightly or wrongly, I really think it's too soon to know, that some kind of plan like the Code of Ethics would be used by the companies themselves to market their own product, and that this wouldn't be useful for them. On the other hand, they had some other ideas that I don't think were correct, but I think they were responding to a lack of information, which is what, you know, they were saying then. So they essentially rejected that idea. So we're back to square one. But what they did do was form a regional network, which was something that people in my circle really wanted to see. And then that was a decision that was raised and taken up and decided on. And that means that they have a regional network with representation from all of the countries, and that each would go home and talk about what strategy would work for them and how they can support each other in those strategies, which is really similar to the model of the Central American Maquila Support Network, mm-hmm. where they meet, you know, periodically, they work on each other's stuff, but they also know what won't or will work where they are and try to support each other in that. And they have autonomy of some funding, but they also meet quite often, you know, and do a lot of skill building stuff and stuff like that. So that's a very dynamic network, and I was really happy that, you know, in a way that people talked about that network there, and now they formed this one. So that was a real good thing to have happen. Two statements were issued when we all came back together for the plenary session, and I have both of these statements. I have not translated them to English, but I'm going to. One is a statement that was emanated by the flower workers meeting, and the other was emanated by the genetic alteration meeting, and with all the signers and stuff, which is good. Good stuff. At the end of the day, we drafted a press release. We were expecting a press conference. And close to the end of the day, we received word that the Plan Colombia had been approved in Congress. I should also say that in our first day's workshop, we received very explicit information from the pesticide experts, many of whom are women. There's an interesting dynamic in Colombia around that, on what could expect from both the fumigation and the use of the fungicide means of killing off the plants, that these are genetically mutating. And I mean, it was like, that was really depressing. I mean, basically, they just locked us in a room and said, okay, guys, this is what this stuff does. You know, we spend our life studying this, and we can swear to you on a stack of Bibles, this is the effect it will have. You know? So that was sobering. And then nobody came to our press conference because, you know, we were upstaged by the Plan Colombia, even though that body issued a statement signed by many people, and it probably went to the newspapers. That's what happened. Some people were from the industry there. They didn't like it. They got mad because a worker got up and testified against them, you know, made a presentation. And so they laughed. And I don't know what the fallout of that's going to be. But that's where we stand right now. We have a lot of thinking to do. I should also add that when I speak about this issue, I've only spoken about it in Canada. I've been invited to the Labor School of the Canadian Auto Workers, which they have. And there, of course, whenever I talk to workers, the first thing they say is, "We'll boycott flowers! We'll not buy any more flowers!" And, you know, I have to explain to people that that's the last thing that the workers want, that they do not want anything that's going to jeopardize their jobs or the industry, mm-hmm. that, in fact, they're proud of their trade, mm-hmm. they're good at it. Mm-hmm. Colombian flowers are the best in the world. Mm-hmm. They happen to like a lot of their work, but they want to earn more and they want to be safe. Okay. And, you know, that's what I need to say. And I was funded to go to this by Canadian Auto Workers, so thank you to them.
Describe the conditions, how much they're paid, okay. the women themselves, sure. what sort of the lives, okay. their values,
no problem.
Religion, and yeah. children and husband.
Okay. It's essentially the same population that would be doing farm labor. There are rural people. There's a fairly big population base on the plains of Bogota. They live in the small towns that surround this hub that's called Facatativá. And then you've got these places, Madrid, and, you know, all these kind of places that where flower workers both work and that the plantations are around them. Pay is around minimum wage. Minimum wage is really low in Colombia. It's less than $200 a month. And it's like $175 a month right now or something. And prices are rising. I mean, you know, the peso is severely devalued. You can't make it on that. So they earn, you know, a ridiculously low wage. They have a lot of overtime issues because during the big holidays and coming up Christmas, Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, they're expected to work overtime, and a lot of times it's not, you know, overtime that's recognized. There's a lot of pressure to work overtime hours. One of the work itself is subjected to ever-increasing pressures. When you talk to people, they'll tell you, like, 10 years ago we were responsible for, let's say, a dozen beds. They're in these raised beds, and bed is pretty big. Now we're responsible for like 40. You know, nobody can do it, and then they're always trying to up the ante. And if every once in a while, people will just say, you know, that's impossible. No one can take care of that many. So you're like running, and like the amount of work, all those flowers are. It's a very labor-intensive job. You're constantly doing things. You know, you do one thing, and then you do another. You're doing, and they actually shape the flowers. I mean, if you look at the roses in the farmers markets around New Jersey, I mean, they actually, each single flower is personally managed and put on a sort of pole, you know, you can see with the carnations, like they're all, it's just, you know, very, very, very contrived. Pesticides are a major issue. Not waiting sufficient time before going back into, you know, after spraying, not always clearing the space for spraying. A lot of those pesticides that they're using there are not meant for use in an enclosed space, and flowers aren't grown in enclosed space. I was flying over the plane with some Canadian trade unionists, and one of them, who always knows interesting things, he looked at the plastic and he told me the grade of plastic it was. And he said, well, hell, anything that's used in there will just stick to the surface. You know, like, so there's things that most people don't even discuss. I mean, this fellow was very useful to me on that trip because he also knew, you know, models of guns and things that could tell me lots of things about what we were seeing. But this is a major issue, health issues, repetitive strain issues, kneeling on damp ground for long periods of time, back problems, certain kinds of paralysis. Every once in a while somebody gets literally gassed with pesticides. Those are major issues. The long hours, leaving home before dark, coming home really late, people are really worried about not having time to care for their children properly. A great many single mothers. Very few men work in the industry, but that's because there is other work available for men in that region. If there wasn't, you'd see them supplanting women, I'm sure. Men, of course, are in the better paying jobs, you know, as supervisors or as constructing the greenhouses and stuff. Men usually fumigate. We've interviewed men. The concern there is adequate health and safety, not having adequate protection. You know, we've looked at the masks they're using. Most people didn't realize that there's a filter that's supposed to go inside the mask, and that has to be changed frequently. So, like, the appearance of safety is there, but without the reality. The lack of adequate information about the pesticides that you're using, you know, and then to sort of go on with what feeds into the environmental problem that is affecting the towns where the people live. I've actually seen rental housing where the people live that's much too close to the field, to the cultivation. There's supposed to be laws about that, but that's not being honored. So you're living right where they're fumigating, literally.
The wells, water supplies?
Water is what I was just going to come to. The flower industry uses so much water, and they're actually emptying out the groundwater underneath the plain. I always try to think, could it fall in? Some of those towns, like Madrid, now buys water from elsewhere. They've run out of water. So that's really scary. And another thing that I think is really scary is all the byproducts of the flowers, like carnation stems and stuff like that, or a material that maybe for whatever reason isn't going
to
sell.
Fed to the livestock.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's illegal to feed. They used to feed the carnations to the cows. The cows love it. And that's dairy-producing land. And then they'd sell that milk. Now, that's illegal now. And once I figured out what's happening. But when we were there with the Canadian, I had the whole delegation with me. And we were in a van. And we saw it. We stopped the car. And we saw the cows eating the red carnations. And like my friend says, hell, you know, we've come out here with journalists and we haven't been able to catch this. And there they are. We have the photographs. Mm-hmm. And so they still, the practice still goes on. So, you know, as I said, you've got lots of women. You've got some men. Some of the men have been really cool, too. There were some really great stories about the day the management ran away. Some of the men raised their voices and like these guys jumped over the fence and ran away. And they have, in Colombia, you have the situation of displacement, you know, remembering that there's a very complicated civil war that's going on, and people are constantly on the move outside of the zones where they've been living because they've been actually moved out of there without compensation in a way, or they're running away. And more people are coming there looking for work that are from that sector, and they're receiving some real lousy treatment on the part of the locals, which is just, you know, par for the course. And so I have a feeling that the demographics of flower work is actually changing again. So we have people from other places coming and trying to get the work. So that's going to just up the ante in terms of making it, you know, more oppressive and more difficult for people to demand any rights. I mean, the general perception on the part of the companies is that you have no rights at all, and you better not read the word union. On the other hand, you know, Colombia is not without labor law and so on, and like, you know, one of my closest friends spends most of her time dealing with these issues. Sometimes they are able to get the back pay, or they do amazing kinds of things. You know, I was in a meeting where she was just handing out the phone number of the owner and saying, you know, just call him up and go for it. Pull out all the stops, you know. In practice, they were probably former supervisors or former foremen or whatever from the plantations began to supply labor to the companies. And so the companies stopped hiring in the way it would normally, like put up a sign and interview workers and hire them. And they started giving that work to these subcontractors. And those are people who are linked into those plantations in maybe by marriage or by lengthy employment. So they become the gatekeepers of labor for the industry. And, you know, they have different ways of hiring people. And, you know, maybe a bus or a van picks you up. And, you know, they are very quick to blacklist anybody who is known to be a troublemaker. I mean, that's a major problem for people. And most of the workers we know are ex-employees because, you know, people, when they have nothing to lose, will begin to speak out or, you know, start to become active. I know people who've worked in the industry for many years, you know, long years, and there's some really interesting leadership, you know, like it was really thrilling for me, like I didn't tell anyone who was coming to Bogota, and I got there the day before, and I was helping put together registration packets, and then I sat at the registration table, and a worker is the first person who recognized me. And she just came in and screamed, you know, and I thought, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know? Like, you know, I just slipped into town like a thief in the night. And, you know, it's really great when you see people who started to get militant and like started to rise and gain skills and travel a bit and, you know, can make a good speech. And, you know, that was really thrilling to see, you know, hardly anyone's dropped out. Everybody was like right there in the pocket. And historically, there's been a lot of different ways. Historically in Colombia, this paramilitary thing, well, that is seems like a new concept. It's an old concept because landowners have always had their own private armies. You've always had in Colombia a weak state and a competition for power, including armed power, very much a characteristic of Colombia. And we still have it today. I mean, it's nothing to change. You know, and we always say Gabriel García Márquez doesn't make anything up. Everything he tells in 100 Years of Solitude is actually things that are lived, you know. And so, I mean, I can remember times when people were threatened by maybe the growers had their own armed thugs, which, is, you know, this happens from here to. At this point in Colombia, who kills the trade unionists? It could be anyone, because you can hire assassins very easily. Sicarios. I had a friend who was killed on campus that way. He was killed in the cafeteria of the law school, you know. We never found out who killed him, but the style of the execution was that style. Now we have a big problem with paramilitary, and the paramilitaries are presenting themselves as forces, almost as armies. At one point they call themselves a co-op, which we understand the international cooperative movement is really angry about and has been investigating. You know, you can't just call yourself a co-op. The co-op that kills people. Like, it was so bizarre. And it's still confusing to people because they present themselves as unidades de autodefensa, self-defense units. And that's a euphemism. Colombia is the land of the euphemism, and that's one of the best. Who kills the trade unionists? I don't know.
Who's afraid in Colombia? What people feel safe because there are paramilitaries and because there is a government? Who is invested still in this?
Okay, that's an interesting question. Because it has to do with your personal psychology. Everybody's afraid and nobody's afraid. You know? I mean, one of the most painful assassinations, of which I can, you know, name a lot of, but for many of us, one of the most painful assassinations was the assassination last year of Jaime Garzón. Jaime Garzón was a journalist. He went to law school at the National University. He was the TA of my former partner, you know, who was always mad at him because he was always cracking jokes. But he, in fact, studied law and was a journalist and became a great, great comic actor and political satirist. His television show was called Quack, and we used to say that is the real opposition in the country. It was a fabulous show. I mean, he did everything, and it was just with a complete abandon and, you know, like beautiful politics. And everyone in the whole country watched that show. And he was assassinated last year. Even the head paramilitary guy said we didn't do it, you know. Like, but I mean, we believe he was killed by the paramilitary because they claim he was too close to the guerrilla, and I guess he was. You know, Jaime was getting a lot of death threats. He wasn't going to leave the country. Everybody's afraid, and nobody's afraid. You know, Ignacio says he's going to go back. I mean, one of the main journalists, investigated reporters for El Espectador, one of the two dailies, went into exile a few days before Beijing Plus Five. And I accompanied him on the day after. And, I mean, just because we found him at BAI, and we hung out with him all day, and we took him to all our meetings, which included a meeting with Kofi Annan's assistant at the UN and with the General Secretary of Amnesty. And Ignacio is won the Amnesty Award for journalism for his human rights work on June 21st, just a few days after he left the country. He's around. But, you know, he's starting to go back to Colombia. I mean, because he's homesick. And, you know, and I should add that there was just a few days before he left the country, there was an attempt on kidnapping him, and he fought off his kidnappers. Mm-hmm. And the kidnappers instead kidnapped a woman reporter from the paper who was covering, and there was the paramilitary. I mean, he exposed in the Espectador the fact that the paramilitary prisoners that are in the big jails are allowed to keep their weapons. So she was like tipped off following a tip, and she was kidnapped and, you know, violently raped and they told her, we're going to cut those journalists up in pieces, go back and tell your colleagues. And she lived. You know, but I mean, that happened like June 1st or something like that, you know. So, I mean, that's a new pattern. This is a new one. We haven't had this experience in Colombia of rape being used as a political weapon. We haven't had it. So now that's going to set off a new wave of things, you know, that's going to be affecting women in new ways. Who's afraid? Everybody's afraid and nobody's afraid, you know. If you're too afraid, then you don't stay, right? But in terms of who... I think what happens is the pressure, and when it gets to be too bad, you leave. Amnesty is pulling people out. They've been pulling people out and taking them to Spain for quite some time. I think my coworker that I share my office with, he went to Spain. He's in Spain. Other people, very, very strong and militant people, were not afraid and continued to speak up, but they've mostly been killed.
That was Cynthia Mellon, a human rights worker from Bogota, Colombia. Good horse,
as we trot in this dark heat, that robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by